Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
All right, Lorraine Bracco has no problem calling herself one tough broad. She's a Academy Award and Emmy-nominated actress. She's best known for her role as psychiatrist Dr. Jennifer Melfi, who treated New Jersey Mafia heavyweight Tony Soprano on The Sopranos, and as Karen Hill in the Martin Scorsese film Goodfellas. And she also appeared for 7 seasons on TNT's blockbuster hit series Rizzoli and Isles. And The Sopranos, you know, it debuted 25 years ago. And to celebrate this award-winning series, Lorraine Bracco is with us. You are one tough broad. You are.
Oh, well, yeah. You know, it was funny the other day. We were talking about the Me Too movement and all of that. And somebody asked me, you know, Lorraine, did anybody, you know, ever try, you know, to do something bad and wrong? And I said, yeah. I said, but they're still on the floor.
Oh, I like that. Yeah, which speaks. So, yeah, which speaks
to
your
story.
I love that. I love that. Well, you're a Brooklyn girl. I mean, you were born and raised in Brooklyn, right? Yeah,
I am. Yeah. And like my kids know, I'm always ready for a rumble.
That's great. Yeah, I was going to say, if I ran into you in an alley, I'm pretty sure you could kick my ass. I'd be scared to death.
Well, let's put it this way. I don't know if I could, you know, beat you up, but I would definitely put up a fight.
I love that. You know, I was looking, like, you know, deep into your past. Like, you weren't really acting when you were younger. You were a model. You moved to France in 50 years ago, by the way, this year, 1974, you moved to France and you became a model.
Oh, my God. 50 years ago?
50. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I loved every second of it. It was a great time.
So what brought you to France? Like, what took you out there?
You know, Wilhelmina Model Agency.
Okay.
They asked me to go. And, you know, I guess the most important thing when you're starting out is to have a tear sheets, pictures of yourself, you know, in your lookbook. And in France and Italy, those were great places to go and do that.
That's cool. And you
did it. Yeah, it was great. Yeah, it was a great experience.
For a decade. And then you were on the radio. You were a disc jockey, Radio Luxembourg.
Yes, but only for a summer.
Okay. Hey, that's cool, though.
I filled in for everybody who was on vacation.
I love that.
But because I could speak French and I kind of knew American culture and what was going on musically in the States, it ended up being a lot of fun.
That's cool. Yeah, that's cool. And I know you were getting some roles like playing an American in some French films, because you said you spoke French. But Someone to Watch Over Me, I think Ridley Scott, that was the first film I think I ever saw you in. It was a great, great movie.
Yeah, thank you. I loved it. And Ridley was a most magnificent human being. And to be one of like a really big, important director, one of my first big, important directors, he put that bar very, very high.
And that helped you. I think, you know, sometimes those first jobs really kind of guides you through your career, right? It's that experience that you have with somebody that really moves you into a different direction.
I agree. It's very important. You know, I think by the way, I think it's for every industry.
Yeah.
You know, your first boss, if he's considerate and kind and wants you to teach and wants you to succeed, is a big difference than somebody who's an asshole.
It's very true. It does set expectations differently for when you get your next job. It does. Absolutely does. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And then
I was very lucky. I've been very lucky career-wise.
Well, then you met Martin Scorsese socially, and I know I've heard you talk about this, that he asked you to read for a different movie, but you never really read for Goodfellas, but he gave you a script to read, and De Niro, who you knew, gave you the book Wise Guys to read, but Marty invited you to his apartment, and Ray Liotta was there. Share that story.
So, I mean, it's a very lucky and simple story. I think a couple of things. You know, my background is my parents moved from Brooklyn to Long Island, and I was brought up in a Jewish neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And Karen Hill, of course, was Jewish.
Right, yeah.
So I think that was a little helpful.
Sure.
And I think basically he just wanted to get a sense of what Ray and I looked like together.
Isn't that amazing?
And how we felt together. And so we were up there for a little while. And, you know, that was it. That was the audition. But that's a master.
Yeah, right.
You know, a director, and I've learned this, if a director casts his movie well, most of his work is done.
That's very true. I love that it was just a matter of seeing you two interact with each other and seeing you two, your faces next to each other. And are you believable as a couple?
Yeah.
And that was it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I mean, and you know, again, I had known Marty and I spent dinners with him and whatever, you know, things like that. So he kind of knew me. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's, I mean, I can't say we were friends, but yeah. He knew me.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I spoke to the late Ray Liotta some years ago, and I remember telling him, you know, that I was watching it with my son, who was in his teens, you know, Goodfellas for the first time. And what he was most curious about is if my son found it interesting and did it hold up. That movie will hold up forever.
I know it's crazy, right?
Yeah. I mean, because it's a period piece, so to speak. And so it's always going to live on. But what a nominated for Best Picture, you nominated for an Oscar, first big role. That must have been surreal for you.
Oh, my God. I still can't believe it.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, look, yeah. I went to work every day with the boys. And every day I said to myself, you better bring your A game, Brocco. And because it was heavyweights, it was not, we were not like all unknown kids starting out. It was, it was a big thing.
If that movie ever pops up, you're turning channels, like as an actress and being in the, do you watch it? Do you stop and you just kind of watch it for a little bit?
I'll watch a couple of minutes, but then I'll go on.
Gotcha. Fast forward to The Sopranos. You did read for The Sopranos, but David Chase, the crew, thought, you know, was to typecast you really as a mob wife again. You thought differently for that.
Yeah. You know, who wants to play one kind of character their whole life, you know? That's no fun. But when I read the script and I read Melfi, that really piqued my interest. I said, wow, what a different way to enter this mob character's life.
Yeah.
I also thought it was very intimate.
Yeah.
And a relationship that we've not really ever seen or explored.
No, and I know you also have felt about, you know, Italian women in film were not always portrayed at a higher level, and you wanted to bring this character, this educated Italian professional woman, you know, to the table.
Right, and I said to David, you know, two things for me. You know, one, I don't think Tony would see someone who's not of his culture.
Yeah, true.
And when have you ever seen an Italian educated woman on screen?
It's true.
You never see that.
No.
And that's a shame because there are plenty of us.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I know when you approached that role, you know, you said you had some good therapists in your life, and that's kind of who you kind of modeled that after. A little bit, right?
Right. I saw a woman for a long time and I saw a man for a long time. So I always say I took the yin and the yang out of them.
I like that. You know, you were curious when you were doing the role of how the character of Tony would pay you. Does he have insurance?
Yes.
I don't think he wanted to put that through the insurance that he was seeing a psychiatrist. So what did Chase ever tell you? Like, how does that work?
I don't know, but he really, when I asked him, he just looked at me like, wow. Because I, you know, like almost like, you know, his mind was racing of how that, you know, was going to happen. But I'm glad I asked him about it. I thought it was an important element to Tony's life.
That's right. I knew he threw money at you once, so I thought maybe cash was involved.
it was funny. I thought it was really funny.
Yeah.
Like I was like all the women in his life, you know.
Yeah.
That he had to give money to.
Yeah, right. That's very true.
I thought it was interesting.
Well, your scenes with James Gandolfini really brought the show to the center. So it was like that moment in the show where, okay, it's away from the crime, the murders, the chaos, the family life. It's where the character of Tony was more honest with himself about his own life and that the navigation that you gave him. But it kind of like it stopped the show for a minute and slowed it down to have a conversation. I just love that part of the show.
I also think, too, you got to see Tony. And look, there are people who skip over the Melfi scenes. They fast forward them.
Really?
I think so. Okay. But the truth of the matter is that's where you really see who he is.
True.
You see him as a father, as a friend, as a enemy, as a husband, a son. You know, you see a lot about Tony in these scenes. And I think that's why people loved him.
Well, and plus it's all about characters, you know, talking about you and Ray Liotta and making sure you were compatible together. You hit it off with Jim right away. I mean, you had a good relationship with him as actors.
Well, I love this story about Jim. I went to go see Jim in Streetcar Named Desire with Alec Baldwin and Jessica Lange.
Mm-hmm.
And during intermission, I remember looking at the playbill and saying, who is this guy playing? I don't remember what character. I can't remember now.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember looking at the playbill, trying to find, and I see James Gandolfini.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, that's a good actor.
Wow.
And this is years
before
Sopranos.
So you had some respect for him as an actor even going in. Yeah, yeah.
I did.
Now, I know when you shot scenes, you know, typically, you know, you shoot from different camera angles and so forth, but the scenes you shot with him, typically done in a day, they shot his side first, and then they would shoot yours, and it was kind of hard to get through those lines because he messed with you.
Oh, he loved nothing more than to mess with me. Anywhere, anyhow, okay? It didn't even matter if it was just on the set. But, you know, he had so much dialogue. He was the precursor of the scene. He had the story to tell. And he was always mad at me. He's like, who died and gave you this job? And I, you know, I was left. But yeah, he used to dance. He used to strip. He used to enjoy himself when he was done. And I would be like an idiot saying, if you don't stop, like a kid, like if you don't stop this.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's awesome. But again.
Oh, no, he was.
Yeah. It gave you good. It was good camaraderie. It was good. It was a good.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Adored him.
Love it. Love it.
I loved him.
We are talking to the iconic Lorraine Bracco, and there's more when we come back on 720 WGN. All right. We're talking to Lorraine Bracco. We're talking Sopranos at 25. I was talking to Vincent Curatola about the fact that there were some cast members that really never crossed paths on the show. But there was one. I believe there was just one that you, your character and Tony and his crew were in the same scene in a restaurant, albeit so briefly.
In a restaurant in Jersey, yes.
Yeah, yeah. But that was that happened, though. I mean, you might have been friends on the set and, you know, and stayed in touch with everybody. But because of the role, you weren't in scenes with some of these people.
Well, I was, I mean, really 99.8% of my time was always just with Jim.
I mean,
Carmela came a couple times to therapy.
Right.
And of course, Peter Bogdanovich.
Yeah. How great. Did you have a favorite episode that your character was significantly featured in, or a favorite episode of the series in general that you watched and said, God, this is good?
I always loved Steve Buscemi directing I Tell Them.
They're
in the forest.
Pine Barrens.
To me, that is a great episode.
Yeah, for sure.
I loved it. I couldn't believe it. Watching the two of them, I thought it was magnificent.
Brilliant. Yeah. Took it off the script a little bit based on what was happening in the rest of the series. At the Emmys, just a couple of weeks ago, you walked back into that office again with Michael Imperioli by your side. It was pretty cool.
You know, I'll tell you, it was, look, I loved that they honored the show that made me so happy and proud. And I can't believe it was 25 years. But
yeah,
when Michael and I went to do rehearsal and we were standing behind the door and they played the music.
Yeah.
And Michael and I looked at each other and we kind of choked up.
Yeah. Yeah.
We couldn't believe it.
I bet.
And I said to him, oh, God, please, let's hope we get through this tomorrow. It was moving for us.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was a little tribute to James Gandolfini, too. So that adds to that, of course.
Totally.
Yeah. I had watched your HGTV series, My Big Italian Adventure, where you renovated an Italian villa that you bought for a dollar a few years back. What a bold adventure that must have been. Or still is that still going on?
Well, you know, it still needs a little bit of work.
Yeah.
But it's livable, which is fantastic. It's great. I love it. I get to go. I like to go during olive picking season.
Oh, okay.
And I like to go in the spring. It's great. I love it. I feel incredibly blessed to be able to have something so, I want to say unusual, remote. Love Italian food. I love the people in the village. It's always thrilling to go back.
I was going to say, it must bring you just such happiness knowing it's there. It's there for you.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
I can't believe it.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. Lorraine Bracco, One Tough Broad. What a great conversation. I'm so grateful that spent time talking about The Sopranos and Goodfellas and your amazing career. And I just love watching you on the big screen and the small screen. You're really amazing, Lorraine.
You're sweet. Thank you. You're adorable. That was fun.
Yeah. What do you got coming up? Any new projects? Anything you're working on? Anything you're thinking about?
I got a movie coming out with Vince Vaughn. I got a movie coming out with Mark Wahlberg.
Love it.
Yeah.
Love it. The iconic Lorraine Bracco. The celebration of The Sopranos at 25 continues after the top stories from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. All right, Vincent Curatola is best known for his role as John Sacrimoni on The Sopranos. Vince began his career as a musician, playing bass guitar in a band that performed at local clubs and bars and on the big stage with the band Chicago and even Chuck Berry and Little Richard. Vince's most notable film roles, I know, it's pretty cool. His most notable film roles includes parts in Killing Them Softly, The Good Shepherd, The Last Request, and he's made endless TV appearances on TV shows like Law & Order, Blue Bloods, mm-hmm. The Good Wife, Monk, and The Blacklist. And Vincent's breakthrough role came in 1999 when he was cast as Johnny Sack on The Soprano and appeared in all six seasons and joins us to celebrate The Sopranos. Vincent, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, it's my pleasure, Dave. It really is. I'm so excited the fact that, you know, we've lasted so long and we've become, I think, even a bigger thing now than we were originally. So
it blows my mind. I mean, honestly, that it's been 25 years.
Oh, yeah. As you know, went on in January of 99 and came off in 07. But you know something, Dave, this is, I have young kids run up to me when I say kids 20 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, oh, my God, I love you. And I say, when did you see the show? You were a child. No. We're watching it. Everybody's watching it now.
Yeah.
And I got to tell you something. I'm not trying to do a plug, okay? But this fabulous invention called Cameo,
Yeah.
People reach out to me daily at, from all over the globe, and I'm able to personalize the greeting. Hey, buddy. Hey, Bill. Hey, Sandra, whatever you are. It's a fabulous system, and I love the opportunity to do it.
What is the most common phrase they ask you to say on Cameo?
Speak, and what is this, the F and U-N now?
Of course.
Okay. I mean, it's,
of course.
And all kinds. I mean, you know, I have done baby reveals, gender reveals.
Oh, my God, really?
I have asked several people to be the best man at so-and-so's wedding. Would you please do it for me? Yeah.
I love that.
It's fabulous. It's a great, but I'm saying the thrust of this is that it's global. It wasn't global originally, initially, and people could just reach out, and it's fabulous. And if it wasn't for David Chase's brilliance of putting this thing together, my God, where would we be?
No kidding. And you know what's funny? Like, you talk about people watching it now. Absolutely, that the next generation. My son's watching it now. Yeah. My daughter's watching it now. But back in the day, you know, you talk about 1999, early 2000s. We were kind of all watching the same. That was probably the last show that on a Sunday night. We made an Italian dinner, and I'm not Italian, but we would make an Italian dinner. We would sit down and watch The Sopranos. But like to watch a show in real time today doesn't happen anymore, you know?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't happen. I have to tell you, I'm the perfect example of a viewer. I don't bother with network television, even though I'm on it quite a bit, thank the Lord. But I can't handle. I see a dumbing down.
Yeah.
And I really do. I'm sorry to say that, but people are so now used to instant gratification of a blip on a cell phone or an iPad that they just don't, wow, what happens next episode of who? I don't care. I never watched it. I'm not going to start. So I think we've gone into that, plus the fact that the reality shows have really, they've really taken over. And they're mindless, in my opinion. No disrespect.
Agree.
What can I tell you?
Agree.
You know?
And I'm looking at your background, like really in the back in the mid, I mean, acting wasn't even part of your life. Back in the
70s? No, not at all. No. As a matter of fact, I don't know if you picked up that piece where the block I lived on in beautiful Englewood, New Jersey, had a paper out, and everybody on my block was a celebrity and a paper customer. Dizzy Gillespie, Sarah Vaughan, Tony Bennett, Jerry Vale, Leslie Gore, Wilson Pickett. These were all my paper route customers, and I saw them, you know, weekly at least. I thought I'd go into music. I wound up, you know, in acting.
Yeah. Well, music is in your blood, of course, but like in the 70s, I mean.
Yeah.
You started your own masonry business. You had a contracting
business. Yes, I did.
Business.
Exactly right. Yeah, Northern Bergen County. My dad had a big company, a big masonry company on his own, but I wanted to be by myself, and I was. Maybe too much so. But I have to thank my gracious, beautiful wife, Maureen, for saying to me, you know, you work hard. You love these films, especially the older films. Maybe you want to study. And I went in and I studied acting with Michael Moriarty, fabulous actor, in Manhattan. And that's how I began.
And that was in the early 90s. So, I mean, you appeared on the original Law and Order and wife nudged you a little bit. You were in that Gotti, the Rise and Fall of the Real Life Mafia.
Right. And then I made my own film called Dearly Beloved about a funeral home in Brooklyn, a comedy. I made that in 94. And I cast Tony Soprano. Tony Sirico, who played Paulie Walnuts later on.
Right.
We were buddies from 92 on, and, you know, we wound up on The Sopranos together. But it's on YouTube. If you want to check it out, it's a half-hour film. It's hilarious.
I love it. So, I love it. Yeah. And then you were on this NBC TV movie, Exiled, and when your agent said, hey, listen, go to Manhattan's West 72nd Street. You're going to audition for this role. And by the way, the role, the guy's 70, but go do it anyway.
Right. I was 45. That's right. Exactly right. And I knew Tony Sirico had already shot a few episodes. But of course, the show had not aired yet. And I'm thinking to myself, nah, I really don't need to do this. I blew out two appointments. My agent finally made me the third one. I guess that was the charm. And that was it. But Johnny Sack was only supposed to appear one episode forever.
Yeah.
But they built him. So.
But I mean, the story behind it, I think it's quite funny because, you're right. You kind of blew it off. And it wasn't a
big... I did. I did blow it off. And then I was late for the actual appointment because I really was not interested. But I think I was tired. I don't know what it was. It's just, I just didn't feel like walking in the room. But you know, thank the Lord I did. So.
But you when you did it and you saw, you were watching some of the other actors, because you know, for every role, there are so many people auditioning. And you, while you were sitting there, you kind of did figure out how you were going to play it and how you were going to audition.
Actually, Dave, you're absolutely right. I went into the audition on a Thursday, and I was late. There was only one woman casting director in a huge room. She didn't even lift up her head. She heard me walk into the room. She said, you're late. Thank you. Goodbye. I'm going home. Okay, no problem. I'm leaving. She looked up at me, Dave. She said to me, no, wait. Did they give you the pages? I said, yeah. She said, sit down. Let's read the scene together. So we did. Then she said to me, I want to bring you back Monday to Silver Cup Studio, which is in Queens, not Manhattan. And I want you to meet some people. And that was my callback. But while I was in the waiting room, I was listening to guys who were in there already, like six or seven ahead of me. And they're screaming. They're hollering. And they're blah, blah, blah. And I'm saying to myself, they don't sound threatening at all. So when I went in and it was my shot, I lowered my voice to the point where David Chase and whoever was there, they leaned forward. No, like E.F. Hutton's going to speak. They had to lean forward to listen because I kept it so low. And the next day I got a call from my agent. They said, well, they want you to do this episode. And there we go.
You know, that comes from good acting, but it also comes from being a fan of the movies because, you know, you don't have to command respect by yelling.
No, absolutely not. I mean, listen, you know, if, God forbid, you're going to tell somebody you're going to kill them, do I have to scream? I mean, didn't I just deliver the message that I'm going to change your life or take your life? You know, that's it, done. Yeah. You just have to talk. Open your mouth and talk. That's what I believe. And, you know, I have a wonderful acting workshop. It's on Zoom. It's international. Mm-hmm. And I also have students in person that come in every week. And that's what I say to them. Don't act. Cut it in half, man, because you're pushing it. Don't push it. Just relax. Yeah. You'll deliver the message, and I love it.
Well, and here's a series, too, that had exemplary writers and David Chase behind everything. Yeah. But, there are some sets where, maybe you can throw in a line or something. This was pretty strict.
No.
You followed?
No, not able to change a word, not even a syllable. That is not an exaggeration. And you didn't try, because if you did, like what, maybe I got a suggestion that's better than that line, but that's not I'm a hired actor.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a contract player. I'll do what you tell me to do. That's it.
But you know, David Chase really let you develop the personality and how it was delivered, even though it was written.
Because
they loved what you did with it.
Well, thank you. I have to tell you something. For you to touch upon that, it's very flattering to me. But I will tell you, never did David or anyone come up to me and say, listen, you know what? We think Johnny is this, or we think he's that. We're not too sure if he would do this. Maybe he wouldn't. They never interfered with me, and I bless them for that.
Well, and it started from the beginning. You know, you were late. They didn't even look at your face. Looked at your face and said, "Okay, wait."
Yeah.
Okay,
wait. Right. Right.
And then and then they delivered that line. So that in the back of their head, they're like, "No, this is the guy."
Yeah. Yes. Well, thank you. I got to tell you something. I talk to Johnny Sack on almost a daily basis. I say, Johnny, seriously, what would you do in this situation? I'm in traffic. I want to kill the guy in front of me. I don't really mean it. Hello out there. I don't really. It's figurative. Okay. And, you know, I hear him say to me, Vince, calm down. You know, you get better. You get quiet. Things go better. But I felt sorry for Johnny for a lot of reasons. I really did. But I mean, I felt that there was an empathy there that was in between the lines of the writing. And hopefully I brought it out.
You absolutely did. We are talking to Vincent Curatola, John Sacramone from The Sopranos. We'll talk more Sopranos at 25 next on 720 WGN. All right, we are talking to Vincent Curatola, John Sacramone, Johnny Sack on The Sopranos. You know, The Sopranos was pitched to several networks. Fox turned it down.
Yeah, I know.
And beginning, you're doing a cable show, and, you know, you're going and doing your job, you're reading your lines, you're doing your best, but when did you realize the series was a big deal, like a really big deal?
that is such a wild question.
Yeah.
It happened on a Monday morning, all right? Not my first episode, Ed, but by the time they got me into the second season, at the point, I couldn't wash my car in the driveway anymore, and I loved doing that. You know what I mean? People would stop, wonderful people. But, you know, once in a while, it gets a little hairy.
Yeah.
You know, you run into the house. Subsequently, we moved to a more bucolic area. But I'll tell you something. When you're working on The Sopranos, of course, you know, people are watching it. You don't know the extent of it, because when you're working, you're in a bubble. And but you know something? We spent a lot of time together, certain cast members. I mean, we socialized like crazy. We did a lot of benefits together. We were on a lot of airplanes together. And, of course, you know, people, it was like being, I, you know, somebody said to me, you know, you guys were like the Beatles of television. I said, well, that's a little extreme. Yeah, I said, but, you know, I kind of get a little bit of what you just said.
I have to tell you,
and I don't mean to be morose or morbid in any way, but I was on the foundation of a major medical center in northern New Jersey, and I saw a lot of things I never want to see again. And there were people who said to me, you know, my son is not in good shape. His room's down the hall. You think he could run in? The kid would be like, you know, 25. He's got 2 days to live. Which I did a lot of that. Not just me. All of us.
Yeah.
And that's what makes you really feel like, oh, my God, I got something to give.
Well, and you guys always were close. You know, still close to everyone. But I'm sure the passing of James Gandolfini was a driving force in keeping all of you connected, even 25 years later, you know?
That's correct. Jimmy was a remarkable guy. He was born and raised a few miles away from me in northern New Jersey. We're very, very close to his wife, Deborah, and to his sisters, Lita and Johanna. As a matter of fact, they're coming to see me sing up in Nyack, New York on the 10th. I'm doing my Valentine's show. I'm a singer with some musicians from the Carlisle Hotel. Look at me.
I love that. Well, you know, it's funny. Okay, I'm glad you brought that up, because I know the late Frank Sinatra Jr. Did an episode of The Sopranos, and you got to know him a little bit, and he kind of needled you.
He nudged me into this. I said, you know, Frank, I'm an actor. I'm not a singer. He says, yeah, but it's the same thing. You tell stories. You're telling a lyric is a story. There's music with it. That's all. Yeah. Same thing.
Yeah.
Give it a shot. And and we miss him. He died suddenly too young.
Yeah.
And we miss him. What can I say?
I host a Sinatra show every Sunday morning here on WGN Radio. So it's 3 hours of Frank. And then we throw in some of the other crooners too.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'll tell you something. I did a series in Chicago some years back. I guest starred with John Hurt. And I did. It was called APB.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember one Friday night in December, we shot inside the zoo.
Oh, yeah.
It was like negative 180 degrees.
Yeah, of course.
And we're dying. And it's funny because the production company said, we got you in a great hotel. It's in the Viagra Triangle. I said, what? What's that? Right? No, he said, older guy. I said, well, I'm not one of them, Bo. I just want to eat. I want to go to my room. I want to go home.
Yeah.
I know you got great steaks at Gibson's and this and that. Yeah. Goodbye. Funny, you know. That's a beautiful city. Michigan Avenue is gorgeous.
I love
really
it.
Gorgeous.
Thank you for saying that, for sure.
Absolutely.
I know you became close to a lot of people on the set. I see you still in videos today. Like, you guys really, there's a bonding there.
Yes, there is. There certainly is. I'll tell you, we miss Dominic Chianese. He moved with his wife to England. And what, you know, I'm sad about that, because he's a lot of fun. I met him on the set of Gotti in 1996 up in Toronto.
Wow.
That's where I met him. And I'll tell you something. You know who's a real buddy, and he's a kid, in my estimation, is Robert Eiler.
Oh.
I mean, we watched him grow up.
You did.
And I was on the phone with him the other day. I mean, you know, Jamie Lynn, same thing.
Yeah.
Tony Sirico, he was my... You know, he was my mentor. He really was. He was my friend.
Yeah, what you saw is what you got on screen, off screen. It was Tony.
Always, Dave. No, he never minced a word.
Yeah.
He didn't give a damn what the reaction was going to be. He just said it, and that was it. Done.
I love it. I love it. Not unexpected.
Absolutely.
You know,
I had him. Go ahead.
Sorry. No, go ahead, sir. Go ahead, please.
I had him in my house. We've got a big home, Maureen and I, my wife. And we have this huge, huge, huge property. And, you know, and so he came to visit, and he said, oh, my God, look at you. You bought a house. It's gorgeous. He said, and I'm looking out onto the park next door. I said, what park? I said, my backyard. Oh, you're right. Get the F out of here. What are you? I said, no, Tony, listen to me. Look at me, Bo. You want me to pull out the survey? It's, but whatever he felt, he said.
I love it.
It was. It took him 20 minutes later. We had him convinced it's the backyard.
That's awesome. That's
he was
awesome.
Hysterical.
That's
awesome. Hilarious.
That's awesome.
But what were you going to say? I'm sorry.
No, that's all right. Yeah. You know, every asking a favorite episode is like asking who your favorite child is, but there must have been a episode that you said, wow, this is a I love this episode. There must be one.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to give you the one. I'm going to give you the one that you probably don't think would be, but the one where Johnny dies.
Oh.
And the reason I say that is because I was able to bring Terry Winter, who wrote the episode, to a medical center, and they advised him on exactly what this character was going to be going through. And then they stunned me when they brought in Sidney Pollack.
Yes, yes.
Okay?
Yeah.
And I met him the first morning on set. He said, I love the show. How we spoke about Eyes Wide Shut, some long scene he did with Tom Cruise. Oh, he said the damn scene was too long, blah, blah, blah. I told Kubrick it wasn't going to work. Anyway, I'm sitting, I'm going, this is, I can't believe he's here. And I can't believe he's going to work with me.
Yeah.
And I've met a lot of people, Dave. I mean, seriously.
Yeah. Yeah.
But he said to me, wow, he says, you know, it cost me $18,000 to get to the set. What did you think, like a bus from China? What do you mean?
What's
$18,000? No, he says that. I bought a new Citation 10 jet. I'm a pilot. And I had to hire a co-pilot because in that kind of a plane you have to have. Then I had to pay landing fees at Teterboro. And I said, you did all this to come and see me. I was.
He could have just taken United. Just saying.
Yeah, right. So you get on a plane. They're paying for it. What are you worried about?
Oh, that's great. That's great.
Yeah. But so many pivotal scenes with you. I mean, you know, I remember all, like, you know, taking that leadership role as the boss and setting boundaries with Tony. The feds arresting your character. And then when you caught your wife, played by the late Denise Barino Quinn, like cheating on her diet.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Well, I got to tell you something. I mean, going back to you asked me what my favorite, I would say, you know, I think I probably did about 90% of my work with Jim Gandolfini.
Yeah,
sure. And I think I was the only character that Tony Soprano was ever worried about. You know, because it was kind of like the USSR. You know, it was like the Soviet Union and the United States.
It was.
You know, we could both hit the button, but then what do we got left? Nothing, you know. But he was, I have to tell you something about Jim. He was the best acting lesson I ever had in my life, and he never knew he was teaching me.
Humble guy.
Tremendously so.
Yeah.
Ridiculously so. I mean, so unobtrusive. I mean, we've been on airplanes, we walked through restaurants, and this guy's just downright shy. But I'll tell you something, when he would hear that somebody was having a bit of a problem, I don't mean in the cast, whatever, this guy would write a check, and I know it for damn sure.
That's amazing.
And nobody knew where the hell the money came from.
Yeah.
That I can tell you, too.
Amazing.
Right?
Amazing. Amazing.
Yeah.
I've got Lorraine Bracco coming on the show, and I don't think that there was ever really, you know, there's a lot of characters that never cross paths in the show.
Right.
You know, but there was one scene, I think, when she was in a restaurant that it was a coincidence. You were all there. That was it.
Doodly effing do, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Because that was way back. That was season two.
Yeah.
That's right. That was season two. And I had not slept the night before. I was still green. I was very nervous. I hadn't slept the night before at all. So we're on the set, and every time I have a line coming up, Vinny Pastore would nudge me under the table like, this is your line. Oh, yeah. Sorry. I mean, my eyes were red. I was nervous. What am I? You know, I'm new.
Yeah.
But, yeah, but you're right. The only time that we crossed paths with Lorraine, wonderful. When my dad died, we were all in L.A. at the Peninsula. I got the phone call from my son. My father passed unexpectedly. She was the one that gathered up the cast to come up to our suite, Maureen and I suite, and stand around, hold hands, and say a prayer.
Wow.
All right?
Wow.
So
I love that. I love that.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to tell you, you know, you said you were the new guy and everything, but so many great scenes they gave you and you carried. I mean, you did a remarkable, remarkable job.
Thank you, Dave.
Vincent Curatola, what a pleasure sitting down with you and talking about this legendary series and the friends you made along the way, right?
Oh, without a doubt.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, buddy. Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye. You too. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, the celebration of The Sopranos at 25 continues after the news next. And to talk about it all, the great Edie Falco joins us tonight. Edie, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
I am fabulous. I will tell you that every role that you've ever played, from Oz to The Sopranos, Nurse Jackie, movies, whatever it was, you never play the same role, and you immerse yourself in these characters, and you knock it out of the park every time in every performance. You do.
Oh, that's very sweet. I appreciate you saying that. I know I've heard a lot of people talk about that, about like, well, aren't you worried that, you know, you're just going to play mob wives? And then what I say to them is that the next time you get offered the role as a mob wife, you say no thank you.
That's right.
It's really that simple. And you hope that eventually someone will come up with something different.
Yeah, exactly.
That's my story.
And each role, I mean, seriously, each role has been so different from the next. I never see you in a previous character in a current role. You know?
That's great. I appreciate that. Well, I hate to say it, but that is my job.
That is your job. I know, and you wear
ideally,
that well.
You know, thank you. I mean, you're not looking at that and thinking like, oh, God, I remember Nurse Jackie said that or whatever, you know.
No.
So hopefully that the audience will follow me along.
And you've been doing this for a while. Your mom was an actress, and you were on stage, I think, when you were just a little kid. I mean, you really got a taste of this pretty young.
Yes, I did. I mean, what I got mostly was seeing my mom. I would just go with her to rehearsals. I was really rather a shy kid, but I was so taken by this weird thing that these grown-ups were doing after work, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
They all had real jobs, and then, you know, and at night and on the weekends, they would come and put on costumes, and it was, like, sort of preposterous and thrilling all at the same time. And then, yes, they started putting me in some of the plays in the community theater, and that's how the whole thing got started. And I caught the bug, as they say.
Yeah, and you did this through high school.
It may not be the time to be saying that.
No, not the time. Not the time for the bug.
Sorry. A different bug.
Yeah, a different bug. But, I mean, high school, college, you did all that as well. And, you know, a lot of people who want to act, they say, hey, well, I want to move to New York. I want to move to L.A. You were really in the center of it all. What was your first big break to you? Like, if you're sitting down, writing it down, telling people the story, what was, like, the first big break where you were like, yeah, okay, I'm in this thing?
Well, that's the thing. It depends on exactly about what your definition of that is. That it might be a play that I did, I don't know, 1,000 years ago, Sideman, which started as a reading in a basement, and then it went to a little theater, it went to another little theater, went to a workshop, then it went to Broadway, and it was on Broadway for a very long time, then it went to London.
Sure.
So it started as this little teeny thing, like, you know, it's like the little train that could, and it... it found its way to a huge audience, and it won the Tony, and it was a very, very big deal. And it was also, it was theater, which is, you know, where many of us started. And to this day, it remains, you know, one of the more meaningful things I've ever been able to do. And I thought to myself, of course, I don't remember making 50 cents from it, but I remember thinking at the time, wow, I think maybe I can really do this. Maybe I can really, you know, make a life of this. And that was, you know, quite some time ago now, but it was a huge chapter for me.
Yeah. And I'm sure, like every actress or actor trying to make a living, you did other things too in New York.
Oh, always.
To make ends meet, right?
I mean, I was waitressing for 1,000 years, answering phones at various places, all that stuff, all the requisite, you know, horrors.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. All necessary. All necessary.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, I was talking to Stevie Van Zandt. You know, it's the 25th anniversary of The Sopranos. And he talked to me about how surreal that experience was, that show itself. And it's a show that consistently shows up at the top of the list when talking about the best TV series of all time.
That's the whole surreal thing. Yes, completely. And I'm so glad I was really completely ignorant to all of this while we were doing it.
Yeah.
Because there's no way that wouldn't have messed with me, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I couldn't be that far outside of the experience of what I was doing. And I think that served me well. You know, something that I deal with a lot in my life is a tremendous amount of gratitude on so many levels. And the fact that I was able to kind of by happenstance become a part of this show, you know, it was another audition in the course of a busy week, and
amazing.
You know, it could just as easily not have happened.
Yeah.
And just you know, how lucky, just how lucky I am.
And yet, you know, I've always noticed you really never look back. I think I heard you say once you may not even seen every episode of every series that you've even done throughout the years. You are really someone that is always looking ahead in all that you do.
Yes, actually, that's quite true. But if I thought there was something to be gained from watching an episode, I would.
Hmm.
Like if I thought, oh, I could learn something from this, or I really wanted to see how this turned, how this particular scene turned out, I will watch an episode for that reason. But I don't watch them just to watch them. You know, it's not like a TV show where I don't know what's going to happen next. So
right.
You know, I'd have to have a real. And it's usually, it can be nerve wracking if I'm not in the right headspace.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That totally makes sense. Totally makes sense to me. I am so thrilled that you took a few minutes, Edie, to spend some time with us, celebrate this iconic series. And I mean, truly was a pleasure talking to you. Thanks for sharing all this with us.
Well.
Good luck with the
new
series.
Thank you. Bye.
One of the greatest guitarists on the planet is the legendary Stevie Van Zandt. Stevie's career includes being a member of Bruce Springsteen's E Street Band, his band, The Disciples of Soul, and portraying Silvio Dante on The Sopranos. And Stevie joins us tonight. Welcome in, Stevie.
Hi, Dave. How you doing?
I am so thrilled that you are joining us. And as I said to you just before this call started, I've been a fan for decades, man. I mean, it's an honor to have you on the show.
My pleasure, my friend.
Very cool stuff. You taught yourself how to play. Because, and this is a different time, and I want to go back to your music origins, because obviously you have such a passion for all this. No one taught at the time when you were in school how to play rock and roll. That wasn't the music that, there was nobody to go to say, teach me rock.
That's right. That's right. That's right. So you had to learn some lessons, and, I mean, learn some lessons. You had to learn from radio and records. And you had to learn from, you know, we had a lot of TV shows back then, believe it or not.
Yeah.
There had to be like 7 or 8 rock and roll TV shows on every week, you know, for a couple of years there. It was amazing. So, you know, watch the guy's hands on the guitar when you could have got a chance to do that.
Yeah, and you were playing by ear. You weren't looking at music. You were playing by ear. You were figuring it out yourself by just watching the movements of some of the bands that you were admiring on the screen.
Yeah. Now, you know, much more difficult for keyboard players. I'm sure people couldn't really see what the keyboard players were doing. But for guitar, it was, you know, right there in front of you, you know, or for drummers, of course, bass players, you know, you could kind of, you know, catch what their hands were doing occasionally. But, you know, mostly, you then learn from your other guys in the neighborhood who, you know, were just better at research than you were or better at, you know, slowing down the records in those days and you know, learning those note by note solos and things like that, you know. Some new guy would know how to play a certain chord or that chord. You'd learn new chords, you know, as you went. And just, you know, do what you could do, you know, because you were passionate enough about it that was your entire focus, you know. There wasn't a whole lot else to do, you know, to be honest. You know?
No,
we weren't distracted, you know.
But you were watching TV and watching these artists on TV, but you were also probably running down some records over and over on your record player back then. Like, what were some of the bands that you were listening to that you said, yeah, I kind of want to do that?
Well, yeah, it started for me with just like everybody else in my generation with the Beatles on Ed Sullivan, February 9th, 1964, you know.
Wow.
I was one of the 72 million kids watching that.
Sure.
And, you know, people watching that. And that was the beginning for me because I wasn't interested. You know, I bought a few records before that, you know, but I wasn't really interested in doing it. Wasn't really interested in show business at all. And it was the idea of a band that attracted, you know, me. I didn't really, you know, have any interest in the solo sort of show business thing. You know, it was suddenly, you know, the Beatles introduced the idea of a band. We didn't have any bands really, you know.
No.
There weren't that many bands around, you know. So, you know, 4 or 5 guys, you know, playing music. And then writing it and singing it and you know, it was something new, and that communicated something completely different to me.
Sure.
It was suddenly not about me, it was about us, you know. It was about the group, the band,
the team,
the family, the brotherhood, you know. And eventually that communicated community, you know. And that's what attracted me, you know. So you learn, and then you go see bands, you know, locally, of course. That was probably the biggest way you learned, you know. You learn, you're watching the guys, you know, up close, you know, from just a few feet away, seeing what their hands are doing, you know, on the guitar neck, and you learn from that. You know?
You said something very interesting in an interview long ago about playing cover songs and how important that is, because that's how you learn and raise your standards, because you're playing the best songs that exist out there, and that kind of really hones your craft.
That is the most important stage of your development. And a lot of people have been skipping that stage now for 10, 15, 20 years. It's a shame, and you can hear the lack of quality because of it. You must not skip that stage of your development. You know, the bar band stage, as we call it, or the club stage of your development, which is, you know, one of the five crafts of rock and roll I've talked about many times.
Yeah.
You know, it is where you set your standards. You know, how else are you going to have standards if you don't actually absorb these songs? And the only way to really absorb them is not by listening to them, but by playing them. And over and over and over until they get into your system. And then that prepares you for the next stage of your development, which is writing. You know, the composition stage of your development has to come after you've established your standards, or else you're going to write very, very mediocre songs. If you want to, write great songs, then try and fit what you're writing into the set you're playing live of your favorite songs. That's how you raise your standards, and that's how you set your standards, and that's how you maintain your standards, and that's how you end up, you know, seeking greatness rather than, you know, drowning in mediocrity.
And then, and you were discovering all this in your teenage years. So here you are doing this. There was really no rock and roll business, so to speak, at that time. How did you like tell your folks, like, this is what I want to do? And did they get it?
Yeah, no, they did not get it. We were the biggest generation gap of all time. I think this new generation gap that's happening now is competitive and may, in fact, prove to be an even bigger generation gap than ours. But up until now, our generation gap was the biggest in history. You know, we're still the only generation in history that didn't grow up to be our parents.
Yeah,
you know,
right?
Even the 50s kids that were teenagers were invented.
It's interesting.
Those kids grew up to be their parents, but the 60s kids didn't.
No, a little more rebellious.
And that was the biggest break.
You and Bruce were friends like in the mid-60s. You met each other when you were both playing the circuit.
That's right. Yeah, I had my band. He had his. There weren't that many bands that got out of the garage. Everybody had a band in the garage the day after the Beatles played this variety show at Sullivan, I mentioned before. You know, like I've often said, February 8th, 1964, there was not one band in America. February 10th, the day after this show, everybody had a band in the garage. But only a few of them got out of the garage. And, you know, maybe there was a dozen bands in our area. And I had one and Bruce had one. So in those days, if you were in a band, you were friends.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And simple as that, because there were just so few of us. And Bruce was the only other guy I met in my life who was completely dedicated to it as I was, who didn't really have any interest in anything else.
Yeah.
You know, you know, for a lot of people, it was a hobby. It was, you know, it was fun on the weekend, you know, but for us, it was a lifestyle right away. We knew that this was, you know, our destiny and our you know, we were just misfits, you know, freaks, outcasts, and did not fit into society, and you know, couldn't see a way forward really for either one of us. You know, where were we going to end up until rock and roll came along and just kind of said, okay, you know, there's an option that I can understand. You know, that's something I can relate to, because, you know,
Well, it speaks
to your
friendship.
We weren't going into sports. We weren't going into the military. We weren't going into our father's business.
Right.
You know, we weren't going to college. It was just like, what are you going to do?
Well, it speaks to your friendship. You guys have been friends for over 50 years. I mean, it obviously speaks to your love for the music and for each other, too. And I don't know if people know this, but when they call Bruce the boss, you named him the boss. You did.
Well, because I was a boss in my world and a very, very respected one. So when I started calling somebody else the boss, people really paid attention to that. Because, they're like, wait a minute. Because I was equally popular, if you will. Yeah. In my, local area, it's more popular. So it was a surprise when I joined his band, in order to, contribute to his success. It was a surprise for most people. And so, it was a bigger surprise when suddenly I said, he is the boss. I'm declaring him the boss. And so when my boss call somebody else the boss, people pay attention.
People take notice. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You arranged the horns on 10th Avenue Freeze Out in 75, which kind of made you a permanent spot on the E Street Band dais and shortly thereafter. But for knowing each other for 10 years, this must have been a tremendous moment of bonding for you guys.
Well, yeah, we have been in each other's bands, before that,
Right.
So it was the final sort of configuration. This is the one that has now. He managed to get a record deal. He managed to get into the business. Which was a real mystery. How do we get into the business? How do we get into the music business? We had been in music locally for a long time, but how do we break into the business was a mystery and a miracle, and he achieved it. And so suddenly we were now going to go public, and all those years of development and playing live locally really paid off, because we were very highly developed for a new band.
I'm an avid fan of The Sopranos. I think that is the best drama that has ever aired on television. I mean, the ensemble, the cast, the writing, everything was spectacular. But you weren't an actor. But the creator of the show, David Chase, he kind of relentlessly pursued you to audition for this.
Yeah, it's just part of David's, rebelliousness, really. He had been in TV a long time, and he just kind of had, it's hard to explain, but he was no longer interested in following the rules. Okay, let's just put it that way.
Yeah.
He had been a good soldier for so long that he was ready to make the move into movies, and he kind of saw this as a movie. He kind of saw the pilot, as a half a movie.
Right. Right.
He was half hoping that HBO would turn it down, actually,
really?
And so he could, so he could add a few scenes and make it into a movie
and be done.
So he's breaking every single rule, too many characters, the camera never moves, too many subplots, very complicated leading man. And part of that rebelliousness was having me be in it.
I like that.
I've never acted before.
But I got that later. Rebelliousness later, that's one of the reasons he brought you into it. He wanted to shake it up. He didn't want the standard. He wanted to have some fun with it and do something different. And the addition of you to the cast was fantastic. Did you first audition for the role of Tony?
Yeah, I did. He brought me down to play Tony, it was very close. It was very close to actually doing that. And then Jimmy came along, and that was quite obvious that he should be Tony. But I went down at first as Tony, and then I said to David, I said, listen, I'm starting to feel guilty about, taking an actor's job here. These guys, they work their whole lives. They go to class. They do off Broadway, and suddenly some rock and roll guitar players coming along, you know, taking one of their jobs. I said, yeah. So he said, okay, well, in that case, I'll write you in a new part that so you're not taking anybody's jobs, you know.
Interesting.
And so that's how it ended up.
Well, you played the character, and the friendship that the character had between Tony and Silvio is kind of the same way the relationship is between you and Bruce. I kind of looked at it in that way.
Yeah. In the end, that was the way to go. You know, I felt I was most comfortable. The writers were most comfortable. I think David Chase was most comfortable with that. You know, they knew that I could bring something to that part that was from real life. I definitely did use my relationship with Bruce and that dynamic between best friends when one of them is their most, you know, their most loyal soldier. You know, you got to be the one sometimes to bring the boss the bad news, you know?
Sure.
And he's going to, you know, yell and scream at you, but your friendship is strong enough to survive it. And it's part of the obligation and responsibility of being that best friend, or in this case, the underboss, you know, the consigliere,
sure.
You know, where you, you know, you're expected to give advice. That's the gig, you know, and sometimes that advice...
good or bad. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sometimes
I mean,
it's tough.
He may not like what he's hearing.
Right,
you know?
Right. Yeah.
I used that, and it was very effective because, David Chase and the other writers reinforced that idea, and so it was very easy for me to understand those dynamics. As an actor, it was a new craft I was learning, so I had to watch those first, you know, those first couple seasons to make sure I was understanding the craft and improving it, and improving all the time, which I was quite happy about. Like I've always said, it's the greatest, you know, acting school in the world. And as I've said many times, you know, you do a scene with Jimmy Gandolfini and you walk away a better actor. No doubt about it.
We talked about so much here tonight, and I want to let people know again, if you want to learn more about this Teach Rock project, the Standards Aligned Arts Integration curriculum that uses the history of popular music and culture to help teachers engage students, you want to visit teachrock.org. You can catch Little Steven's Underground Garage, Stevie's radio shows on Sirius Channel 21 and syndicated throughout the country. And for more on that, visit undergroundgarage.com. And for more on Little Steven, you can visit littlesteven.com. Stevie Van Zandt, thanks for joining us again, and be well, my friend.
Cool, Dave. Thanks. Same to you.
Thanks, Stevie. All right, much more ahead on 720 WGN. One of the stars of The Sopranos was Stephen Chirippa, who played Bobby Baccalieri, and he also plays DEA investigator Detective Anthony Abitamarco on CBS's Blue Bloods. And Steve is joining us tonight. Good evening, Steve.
Hey, Dave. How are you, buddy?
Getting Baccalieri and Abitamarco out was a little bit of a challenge.
Well, you did good. I
did all right.
They're not easy. They're not easy names. They really aren't easy names.
No, they aren't. But, you know, I'm looking at this. You know, I jump into The Sopranos like every 6 months. I'll pull it up on Netflix. I'll throw in the DVDs.
Yeah, you know, it's amazing because, you know, it's so out there all the time. You know, it's either in the paper, in the magazine, it's on TV, it's always mentioned in articles. So it really is something. And not a day goes by usually where someone doesn't mention something about the show, whether it be the ending or asking about someone or, you know, recognizing and not one day goes by. So, you know, it's been a great thing. It was a moment in time, Dave, that will never happen again. You know, it was a bunch of us, David Chase, put together. It was a hit that everyone watched. I mean, you couldn't ask. It's tough to get on any show, but to get on that show was like hitting the lottery for sure.
Absolutely.
You know, so it's been great. You know, I still keep in touch with a lot of the cast members, and we're still really good friends. And that's what I mean by a moment in time. You know, most of the time you work on a show, you go in, everyone's polite, you work together, and then you go home at the end of the day. This was The Sopranos was more. We traveled together. We had weddings and babies born and divorces. And, you know, we were truly a family. And, you know, we traveled together quite a bit. We spent a lot of time together. You know, doesn't usually happen that way.
No, it doesn't. But, you know, you got to look at this show and say, you know, every list that's ever been done on the best TV dramas, best television shows ever, TV drama or comedy, Sopranos is like at the top of the list. Every list.
Well, listen, it holds up today. It was funny. It was smart.
Yeah.
I would assume 50 years from now, the way you know, shows are on the air, I would assume The Sopranos would be on the air. You know, it is much more than a mob show. You know, some people got that wrong. You know, oh, it's just another mob show, killing and cursing and sex, and it wasn't that at all.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It was so much more. So such a smart show. You know.
It was. And, you know, I want to talk a little bit about you. You know, you began in the business, you know, understanding your bio as an entertainment director at the Riviera Hotel, which opened back in 52, long before you were around. Ninth hotel ever built on the Strip. The first high-rise ever in Vegas. How did you get into that business?
Oh, well, let's see. I moved to Vegas from Brooklyn. I'm from Brooklyn, New York. I graduated college. A friend of mine moved out there. I had nothing going on. Got in a car. Went to Vegas. I bounced. I delivered pizza. I was a bouncer at Paul Anka's club, then bouncer some nightclubs. And then I got a job at the Riviera at the comedy club, you know, seating people. I wore a tux, you know, taking tips. And I was got into the entertainment business. You know, then I was running three showrooms, and I started acting then. Some of the comics put me in little sketches and little things and got the acting bug. So it was a hobby and pursuing it. I got a promotion. It was either that or they were going to fire me. So they promoted me the American way. You fail upwards. And then I became the entertainment director where I was booking acts. So I booked all the acts. I booked every big comic and, you know, the Beach Boys and Bobby Vinton and, you know, some. So you either got them on the way up or on the way down. The Riv at that time was kind of, you know, not a top tier hotel, but it was a terrific experience and a great job. And that's how I got into it. And I just started dabbling and going on auditions in L.A. And when something came to town in Vegas, Fear and Loathing, Chicago Hope, you know, I would audition, get a couple lines here, a couple lines there. And then I went back to New York for a wedding. And I auditioned for The Sopranos, and that was it.
Well, you know, and I was going to say, while you were at the casino, I want to go back a little bit. The movie Casino was still one of my favorites to this day, was filming at your hotel. And, you know,
yeah, you know, it was filmed at the hotel. I got two lines. That's where I got my SAG card. I was in the scene. You could barely see me or hear me if you put it on slow motion. And you hear me yell, "Joey, look out, look out." I was with in the scene with Pesci when he stabbed the guy with the pen.
Yeah, right.
You know, you could barely see me, but it was a great experience. It was De Niro there who, if you say hello to him, he's stuck for an answer. But Joe Pesci's a wonderful guy, and it's Frank Vincent. And, you know, and we worked for 16 hours, and that was fun.
No, De Niro was eventually in the movie. De Niro was the entertainment director of the hotel. So essentially, he was playing you. He was playing you
exactly.
In this movie.
There you go. There you go. But that was fun. You know, I barely was in it. But, you know, and then I got a little here, a little there. You know, I did a movie in Toronto, and I worked with some real actors. And that's kind of was the epiphany where, you know, I told my wife, I think it was 3 in the morning. It's 12 o'clock Vegas time. I was in Toronto shooting, and I said, I think I can do this. I think I could really do it because I was always dabbling, you know.
Yeah,
and and, you know, I said to myself, can I do this? Or if I pursue this more, do I get more? Or is this all it's going to be?
Yeah.
You know, that's kind of was the question. Was it just two lines, three lines as a hobby? And then, you know, I took the plunge, you know. I mean, I had two kids. I was 40, 41 years old, and I moved to New York, and I took shots. Luckily, it worked out.
Yeah, that's awesome. Now, how did you get the call for The Sopranos? Was it during the first season that they...
It was the second season. It was 1999. Yeah. A friend of mine had gotten married. A friend of mine was a writer for Saturday Night Live. He was a comic. He was at my wedding 10 years before, and I said, if I ever get married, if you get married, I promise I'll be there. So he was getting married in New York, and my wife couldn't make it, and I went out on my own. I flew to New York. I was in a hotel. It was an afterthought. I had an agent looking out for me. I wasn't even signed with him. And I said, hey, see if you could get me to read for that Soprano show, which I really didn't even see. I didn't really know what it was. And I went in. I read for the role of an FBI agent. She said, I don't see you as that. Read this. We have someone in mind. And I read the part of Bacala cold. And she asked me, what's this on my resume? And a week later, they call me back, which I wasn't going to go back. I said, I'm going to blow the money. I got to put myself up, fly myself out.
Yeah.
And my wife said, go. So for the first year, I did 6 episodes. It cost me $24,000 to make $22,000.
Oh, jeez. I got to think about that. Yeah.
You know, luckily, I was okay money-wise. And
it was an investment.
Yeah, I took a shot, and my boss at the time, gave me the time off. I had a lot of vacation, like 6 weeks, and so, it worked out. And the next year, they made me a series regular, and I moved my family back to New York. So, right place, right time. If guy don't get married, we're probably not talking, Dave,
Hey, right, exactly. I know, that's so awesome.
The thing is, he just got divorced, so.
Oh, no.
Well, if he doesn't get married, I was talking.
It's a lot of fate.
I was talking to my agent this morning, about stuff, and it really is. It really is the right place, the right time, just like anything else, just like in sports, just like in a lot of things, you think about it, if this guy didn't leave, I wouldn't have got this job. And if this guy didn't put a good word in for me, or if I didn't bump into this guy, it's kind of amazing how things happen.
Love hearing that. And this cast, it was the ultimate ensemble. I mean, talk about James Gandolfini, DeFalco, Tony Sirico, Steven Van Zandt. The list is endless. It must have been, once you got into the rhythm of that show and actually got to see some of the first season, and as you started progressing through the seasons, it must have been a little surreal to be on that set.
Well, it very much was, especially at the beginning. I mean, I had never worked in New York, I was, even though I was from there, I wasn't acting. My stuff, the stuff I did, wasn't a ton. It was enough to know not to, bump into the furniture. I knew all these little crappy things that I had done. I learned, how to hit your mark and how to do this. And, I knew what I was doing to a degree. My first scene was with Tony Soprano and 4 of the guys.
Right.
Pretty intimidating. I didn't know anyone. I was staying in a hotel in New Jersey on my own. Had to get there on my own. Went to the set. Didn't know a soul. And we did the scene. And it was, I got to tell you, after the first scene, it was a scene where Tony Soprano was yelling at Bobby in the pork store, threatening him.
Oh, yeah. We played it on the way into the interview. Oh,
yeah.
Yeah,
that was my first scene.
Yeah.
And I have to tell you that once it was over and it went well, boom, I was part of the group.
Isn't that
something? It was like, okay, we did this scene. There's all these guys, me and these stars of this show, and the show's exploding. And it was, I think July now of, they just got nominated for 16 Emmys, first cable series ever.
Yeah.
And the show was starting to really roll along. And, once I finished that scene, I was part of the club. And then later that night, I shot a scene with Uncle Junior and Tony Soprano. And Jim said, let's go in my trailer and run lines. And it was the three of us. And I honestly kind of took a step back and said, how the hell did I get here?
That's awesome.
I mean, really. I mean, look, I'm in the trailer with these two guys.
Yeah.
I mean, Johnny Ola, Jim Gandolfini, two terrific actors.
Yeah.
And how the hell did I get here? I mean, that was surreal to me.
Yeah.
And at that, it was a moment late at night. And, they were signing me up for one episode. And I remember Jim saying, I'll see you again, you know.
And there
pretty,
you have
that was amazing, you know.
Oh, nice to be working
back. Sometimes even now I'm acting, and sometimes you take it for granted after a while, and it's the grind of it and waiting around, and then you go, man, you know how lucky I am to be able to do this?
Yeah.
I mean, really, you know how lucky I am to be able to say these lines and be on a great show, which I'm on again, you know, Blue Bloods, and to work with these actors. I mean, sometimes you don't stop and smell the roses. You know, I try to do that as much as possible because it's a tough road, you know, and just like a ball player, I would hope, Anthony Rizzo from the Cubs, goes, wow,
yeah,
isn't this fantastic that I get to come out here to Wrigley Field, play ball, and I assume a lot of guys do. I sure hope so, you know.
Well, and you got to do it in the city you grew up in. See, that's even more.
No, it was great. Yeah. I mean, the thing exploded, you know. I mean, hey, listen, there was a time, 6, 7, 8 of us where we went out at night after we were working, we would go to dinner and go out, hit a few spots, and it was like playing for the Yankees, man. I mean, places would stop.
Yeah.
People would give you a standing ovation. I mean, restaurants stunned that it looked, here's six of the guys, we actually hung together and ran around together, and our wives were friends and vacationed together. And, it doesn't come along that often. I mean, it's a tough business. Most businesses are. It's a tough business, you know.
And
I was very lucky to be a part of it. Like I said, a moment in time, very, very lucky. And I'm very aware of that. And the material was great. And the writing was great. And
oh, absolutely.
David Chase is an absolute genius. And you would get the scripts. I was a fan of the show. I watched it on Sunday nights like everyone else.
At some point, did you notice when David was writing for you and stuff that they got to know you personally and as an actor, and they were truly just writing for you?
Sure, no one ever said a word to me. No one ever said, Bacalar is this guy. Nobody ever said anything, not once.
Yeah.
Listen, this is the guy, this is who he is, and he's this, he's that, he's this. No one said a word to me. So I made my own choices, my own choices. I was green as an actor. I got an acting coach in New York. I worked one-on-one. I worked very, very hard, I almost did it in reverse. Yes, I had, worked with a coach in Vegas when I was starting, but now I really kicked it in gear, and I would, for the 8 years on The Sopranos, I worked with a guy in the East Village. I would go to his apartment a lot of times before I shot the scene, then went to the studio and shot the scene as is, just like we just rehearsed it. So I worked a little bit in reverse. I was feeling my way and learning as I went along, working obviously with great actors. I mean, the Lake House, I'm working with 3 Emmy Award nominees. You're sitting there, you're going, geez, this is, how the hell am I, what am I doing here?
That's awesome.
So there was a lot of that, not intimidated, not intimidated at all, just, matter of fact, this is what it is. This is how I felt. And, the material kind of, obviously, when you're working with good material, it's easier to be a good actor,
Sure. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Just like Blue Bloods, the writing there is so good. I've worked on shows that aren't great. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I know how hard that is.
And now you're on the other side of the badge a little bit. You're playing a detective, so that's got to be fun because that's what you wanted to do.
They say there's a fine line between a mob guy and a cop, isn't there?
Yeah, that's true. right.
This is great because obviously, you get typecast and you're put in a box and they just want to see you play the same.
No, you've done a lot of different stuff. You've done a lot of
I've tried not
stuff.
To. Yeah. I've really tried to stay away from that because I don't think it could be done much better than The Sopranos.
Agree with you.
I really don't. I don't think you could be a mob movie, a mob show. Obviously, Goodfellas, Godfather, Casino, great movies, but a lot of bad mob movies,
true.
A lot of bad mob movies,
true.
Hey, I'm going to break your head. I'm going to kill you. How many times can we say that? Can we do that? So when Blue Bloods came along, I was extremely happy to play in New York, kind of disheveled, out of shape detective who was very smart. and very loyal. And the writing on the show is fantastic. And that's
well, the top dramas again. I mean, you're on one of the top dramas again. I mean, seriously,
yeah. 14 million people are watching. Yeah. It's a great, great, great show. Great actors, and once again, shooting on the streets of New York. So, you know.
Very
good
cool.
Stuff.
Very, very cool.
Happy to be there, you know?
And tell you, next time you're in Chicago, let's do this in studio. We'd love to see you.
I'd love to. You know, my favorite Italian restaurant, maybe anywhere, Quartino.
Oh, yeah.
Great, great restaurant.
Excellent.
Great, great, great.
Thank you, my
love
friend.
Love it there.
Appreciate
okay,
it.
Okay, pal.
All right, take care of yourself. All right, bye-bye.
Bye.